Welcome, folks. I'm glad to have you here. My name is Beth Manuel. I work for the Ann Arbor District Library in the Outreach and Neighborhood Services Department. And the reason we're using a microphone in a small room is because we're going to film this event. And if your friends aren't here, they can catch it on our website in a month or two. Is it AADL.TV? AADL.TV. So you can see other programs there as well. I want to ask you to take time at the end of the talk to fill out our evaluation, and they're over on that table right now. And I do want to welcome Greg Orfila, and it looks like it's old home week for him. He's got some friends here, and I'm glad to have him. I look forward to hearing about your book, and we also have it in our collection, so you'll be able to borrow it. And they're for sale also outside. Thank you.
Nice to be here with particularly good friends, truly good friends, and new faces as well. Thanks for braving a cold night. I hope this keeps some of the cold away. Kingdom of Rags. Speak to me, Santee and Los Angeles streets, of a world of color flying by on a metal rack, skeletons of dress patterns shivering on a shoulder. I am listening for the sound of buttons jumping in a box, men groaning under bolts of cloth. I was the man, or a boy, flying by with color, shaking the buttons like the dice of my future, groaning with the men under worsted. And now, half my life is gone, and Santee Street is silent. I put my ear to the wind. The wind wing of his pale blue T-bird. In my young summers and on weekends, I was drafted to ride with my father to the factory downtown. I don't think it was an order. We were a Schmata family, a brood familiar with rags. A century ago, my father's Syrian father was the original linen merchant in Cleveland, Ohio. My eye for beauty, both natural and false, must owe something to the display window on Colorado Boulevard of Awat of Pasadena. My maternal grandfather's Corday handbag place. It was as automatic for us children to work in a garment factory as it is today for kids to jigger the joystick of a computer game. In 1955, my father, with outside man Earl Racine, began his first dress firm, Le Greg of California. A stylish conjoining of the names of his two children, Leslie and Greg. Dad's first make was an orange sleeveless dickie. Right here. And we weren't alone. There were dozens of women's garment factories in the lofts and warehouses fanning out from the epicenter of the Cooper Building at 9th and Los Angeles streets. They were named as we were named for wives and children. Jan Sue, Nancy B., Patty Woodard, Young Edwardian, Edith Flagg, Jody Tutique. And they were all selling the sun in a garment. Forget vacation. Slip this on. Did I say this was Los Angeles? This is Los Angeles. Le Greg had some real hits, a striped tent dress that coyly hid baby making of the 50s, sleeveless blouses, and full bouffant skirts, $6 retail for a set, $6. Something a Texas chain called Margo's named and adds a pleat treat. A main boutique enlisted Women's Wear Daily as an agent, asking the publisher to call Le Greg's to order the hot item, a sailor-collared chemise. But the rag trade was always precarious. And by 1963, the business had capsized. As my father once said, I'm not in one business, I'm in five, meaning for each of the four seasons, plus holiday, a manufacturer had to restyle his dress line. in this garment pantathlon, if you slipped during one season, if, for example, one hot style was made poorly by the contractor, had a bad fit, or was undersold, the garments all flooded back, and your kingdom was in a heap, you and yours were unstitched. But rag people came back. That was the meaning of rags. You were used to reuse. Dad named his new company Mr. Arif, as if afraid to entrust his luck to anyone but himself. He took no partners. It worked. The company was the first to style and make the granny, soon de rigueur for every protesting co-ed. It landed him in Time magazine. His designer, George Wilner, revealed the genesis of that number, and I'm quoting George now. "A small retailer from Glendale brought me something in calico he said his daughter's friends had made and that the kids liked it. We found some leftover calico print fabric, some ruffle, and in 2 hours I had it styled empire with cuffs like Empress Josephine, cut and stitched. Marty Bogash, our head of sales, took it onto the Broadway to Walt Dixon, the buyer, and we sold $10,000 of the granny in one day. It took off like a rocket." By the end of the 60s, Mr. Arif was a million-dollar operation with 70 employees. The company bought out another venerable firm, Ronell, and started two other labels, By George and Madison 7. I think that was the phone number, Madison 77405. Amazing what you remember. Amazing what you forget, too. Ah, the first sacrament of the day, Howard's Coffee Stand, a little nook at the entrance to the Cooper Building. "Cream and sugar, Arif?" "Yes, Howard, as always." "As always, donut?" "Donut, as always." "As always, donut." I liked the way Howard's baritone pronounced sugar, as if he were giving the manufacturer his last sweetness of the day. Then Dad and I strode down the gauntlet of showcases that lined the hallway entry to the Cooper Building. Dad would whistle at his own showcase and call the mannequin doll. And I would thrill at how prominent was our tent-dressed temptress. Once the goods, anything made was good, were clipped of threads, I took them to shipping. I tried to first fill the orders of my Aunt Vinnie, Circle Fashions on Pico Boulevard, and Aunt Jeanette, Jeannie's Casuals on Reseda Boulevard. The family was in rags from start to finish, father creating the styles, grandfather stitching the cloth, and my aunts vending it. Bobby, the black shipper, gave me a pile of clipboards. Soon he and I were picking, swiftly unhooking dresses by size and color for each of the store's orders. Fred, the Chinese-American head of shipping, riffled through the dresses on the silver rack one last time, looking for any error, a collar misironed, a missing button, double-checking our work. Then Bobby and I set to it, boxing and bagging. Soon the smell of the gummed, wet brushes of the old tape machine filled the air, and the sound of tissue and the boxes stacking. Before noon, when I went out on the street, I took my orders from several workers. Jesse and Jose, the cutters, wanted their patterns. Our French designer, Maria, who had a hunchback, asked for buttons and silk thread. Eddie Gold, our old bookkeeper, reminded me, paper spools, dear boy. Time for lunch. Speak to me, Sam's, of Frank's Grilled, Sliced, Basted with Mustard. Sam's, on 9th below Spring Street, just around the corner from Manufacturers Bank, was always crammed. There was something about my father in these few moments of wild ease, jawing with the waitress, the vein along his temple relaxing for the first and last time in the day, his fork cutting the franks without bun as cleanly as he would cut cloth, that made me know I would never know anyone like him. The sheer life of him, the irreplaceable style. After lunch, I picked up a pattern from the pattern maker on Spring Street, inhaling the acrid ink and dyes. I wheezed a bit, sensing in the ink a writing life. One by one, I ducked into the specialty shops for the spools and the thread and the buttons. Everything in the streets was in motion, dresses, racks, bolts, models' posteriors, the thighs of shippers. More than once, I picked up a skeletal original pattern thrown off the rack by a pothole in a crosswalk, a casualty of beauty. After Bobby and I had finished bagging or boxing our shipments for the day, I'd peer in on my father. I might see Cy Harris, the piece goods salesman, running the latest swatches through Arif's fingers. My father had the hands of a pianist. He knew cloth. He lived by feel. Same here. At Christmas parties, Dad liked to dance between the racks with Janine, head of his CalMart showroom, a stunning tall brunette with blue eyes. He also liked to twirl the sample maker's mannequin, riddled with pins, or churn it with George Wilner himself. We enthused each other, Wilner, a former professional dancer, remembered. A big order made an explosion of joy, and it spread through the whole factory. If we ran out of A and B bags or a certain box size, I was sent to the 11th floor of the Cooper Building, where Charm of Hollywood, the well-established rag business of my uncles Albert and Victor Orfila, had the whole floor. Al and Vic and Arif were good to each other, rose together, sank together. Uncle Al's son would go on to start with his father's savings from the ailing rag trade, Kinko's Copies. By 1977, Mr. Arif and associated labels had come undone. It was part of a cloth cataclysm that left few garment houses downtown intact. How did a world die in so short a time? There are so many reasons. It is like trying to finger one termite for a collapsed foundation. Most relevant, perhaps, few children and almost none of the grandchildren of the rag owners grasped the baton of the life of a sweatshop. My father was plain worn out, and he let me know I was meant for better. Was I? Is it? This writer's life, is it better? And did I retreat to a large bureaucracy out of fear of the roller coaster fate of rags? None of us in the younger generation kept the cloth faith. My cousin did pretty well starting Kinko's. Huge profits and employment created, yes, but something you can wear? Can feel? My uncle Gary, the youngest son of my contractor grandfather, went to work for Unical. There's something made there, to be sure, but it's no more yours than it is the creation of hundreds of thousands of other stockholders. And how do you get your hands on a tank of gas? And me, could I hold this article over my head, call it a rain cap? Yet in the dark hours after making nothing but meetings all day, I stitch a book. It is made. It has weight. And it makes no money. Just like all the beauty my father fabricated. Finally. Do I want the reader to pull a book on like a good sweater? Yes. I want it to wear well, to comfort, to awaken, even like a good burlap, to itch. Loft by loft, floor by floor, I ascend the Cooper Building. Only one manufacturer is left in the cavernous place of jobbers and ghosts. When I tell Edith Flagg who I am, her breath goes out. She remembers immediately my father's violent death a few years after he closed Mr. Arif. Back east, my wife won't take the brass buttoned turquoise denim pantsuit the last manufacturer gave me. It has an elastic waist, she says. It's for seniors. I put it up for auction, our church's fundraiser in the spring. Nobody bids. I seem to have lost that outfit, just as I did my father, without saying how beautiful everything he made was. Maybe the errant pantsuit is dancing in a closet with my father's granny dress. Maybe some widowed grandmother pulled it out of a pile, put it on, and is now prowling the corridors of Congress. It was a kingdom, not a Congress. A kingdom of color, of feel, of voice, of tags. It was a kingdom of rags. Oh, any water anywhere? Water, water. No. That's okay. We're Arabs. We're used to the desert. One of my father's fellow GIs in World War II who served in his battalion, the 551st Parachute Infantry, about which I wrote a book, Messengers of the Lost Battalion, is with us tonight, Roland Barheit and his wife, Anita. And his daughter, Cindy. Sorry, Cindy. Well, I obviously, again, it's wonderful to be here. I grew up in a manufacturing town, which is Los Angeles. Most people think it's Tinsel Town. But there's a lot more to LA than the Hollywood industry, and it is actually a place of quite a bit of heavy manufacturing. Everything from aerospace to, in our case, not so heavy, but the manufacturing of clothes. The center of Los Angeles was, for a long time, a rival to, thank you, Beth, the garment district in New York City, which, of course, is quite large. Wow. Feast or famine, thank you. It's a cornucopia of water. Alan was silent. Well, you know, I can last a while now. So I have great empathy for, you know, what Detroit has gone through. I was here today, earlier in the day, doing some consultant work at the Arab American National Museum, which is a wonderful place. My old colleague, Kristen Hodges, who taught with me at Stanford in the back, she teaches here in the area, history, I believe, right? English. Well, all English buffs. And I told her about it today at dinner, and it's a wonderful place that you must go see if you don't know it. Ron Amon has worked there for many years, and it's just the best institution I think we have in the country, other than, I'd say, St. Jude's Hospital, which Danny Thomas started in Tennessee. They're going to put an exhibit on the middle Arab Americans and military service. So we brainstormed for 8 hours today. It was quite a discussion, Ron. It was very intense and very interesting. We had people from the Japanese American Museum in Los Angeles that came, which was quite fascinating. I thought I would read, in addition to Kingdom of Rags and Whole, a little part of two other essays. That's a fairly short piece. These two essays are longer, and I couldn't try your patience with either one of them. The first one is called The Barber of Tarzana. That's what I think. Did you? Oh, wonderful. Another, a Valley Girl. I actually have a... You're going to have to get this book for one reason.
I didn't even know who you were. I just saw the title.
Really?
Went,
sweet.
I saw the title.
It's L.A. But there's a essay that I thought about reading. Shoot, maybe I should. Well, it's called Valley Boys. and it's actually an sort of imaginative rendering of my growing up alongside Daniel Pearl, the Jewish guy who was killed in barbarically in Pakistan. I didn't know him. But I found out, you know, ex post facto, that he grew up like a mile or two away from me. I grew up in Tarzana. He grew up in Encino. Crespi.
Oh, my God.
Where did you go?
Providence.
Oh, you were at our dances.
But,
we'll talk later. These good people don't want to hear about our dances. Had enough dances already. There was dancing in the first one. Barbara of Tarzana, so Valley Boys is about Daniel Pearl and I growing up together but not knowing each other. And I tried to, you know, imaginatively understand how such a terrible thing could happen. Anyway, I'll let you read that on your own. The Barber of Tarzana is about my barber of 40 years in L.A. named Luigi Venti. He still cuts hair a little less accurately. You have to kind of dodge as he's... but he's a wonderful man, and he cut the hair of Bud Abbott. Actually, he cut the hair of just about everybody you could imagine, Harrison Ford, when he was a kid. I'll go to him. I definitely need it, probably this weekend, as I'm going out to L.A. tomorrow. So I'll read a few pieces from The Barber of Tarzana, which I think is somewhat of a light piece, and then we'll go to the last piece, which is not. And it's called An Act of Forgiveness. But let's start with The Barber of Tarzana. Who is one of the longest operating barbers in California? Who once cut Al Jolson's hair? Who had his barbershop rammed by an arsonist? There's a story to that one. Who has been trying to make me stylish for 40 years without success? You're not getting any younger. It's time to comb it forward. The Nero look. His name is Luigi Venti, 84, of Venti's elite barbers in Tarzana. Elite, because when you go under the Venti blade, you become part of a fraternity that stretches back to 1939, the year Luigi, also known as Louis, graduated from Barber College, the youngest registered haircutter in Los Angeles. He was 17. The elite fraternity ranges from actor Harrison Ford to Olympic champion diver Dr. Sammy Lee. Anybody remember? Who long ago cut out my tonsils. It includes anyone who needed to sharpen up at risk of bloodletting in the vicinity of the Los Angeles Convention Center, 1939 to 41, Wilshire and Robertson Boulevards, 42 to 45, Burton Way and Doheny Drive, 46 to 62, and Ventura Boulevard and Corbin Avenue, 63 to the present. That's where he is now. He's right down the street from my mother. And it includes my hero, Bud Abbott. You're all familiar with Abbott and Costello. Okay. One day when I was a 12-year-old riding a lime green Schwinn down a phalanx of palms on Oakdale Street in Tarzana, I caught sight of him watering his modest lawn at Red Wing Street. Luigi had told me the great Abbott lived there, and I always slowed hoping to see him. That time I lucked out. Abbott was in a bathrobe, holding the nozzleless, drooping hose like a defanged snake. The lecturer, Abbott's definition of the comic straight man, called it a lecturer, looked up. I waved. Bud waved. I pedaled furiously to the barbershop where I announced my sighting. Naturally, Luigi was pleased. Had I seen the sign, "Hi, neighbor," on the mailbox? No, I hadn't. Well, that was all right. Next time. Early on, Luigi developed a unique way to cut hair, a process he called the four-phase system. In phase one, the customer would receive a basic trim, a cleanup of the neck. In phase two, Louis would begin to cut hair, exposing the ears somewhat, taking about an inch off the top. In phase three, he would take the straight razor around the ears, producing an arc of flesh. And then came phase four, total butchery. It was in the height of his ecstasy at phase four that Louis was known to reveal scalp. A head with the venti, under the venti hand at phase four had to be ready for anything. It was his ninth, his pieta, his remembrance of things past. Luigi could make a head at phase four resemble Dresden after the firebombing. Not a hair on the head remained more than a millimeter long. For years, Louis tried to persuade me to beg off phase four. Wouldn't I prefer an Ivy League blow-dry? Or the fullness of the Madison Avenue cut? I knew what he was trying to do, to avoid the ultimate pain of creating one's best. It's possible, too, that he had had it with the wrath of my mother. My mother spread bad word over Louis. She liked me with short hair, mind you, but phase four? Even when I let my hair grow long for a time in college, I eventually sought out Louis for my traditional phase four, a rebellion against the rebellion. Why are you still going to him? My mother said. Why does the earth orbit the sun? Why do swallows come back to Capistrano? Louis learned the normal cut at barber college. He was done with that early. She would throw her hands up and say that I was crazy. Now flying in from the east for family and a cut, I no longer get her frowns when I mention Louis's name. Now my head is phase four. Luigi could cut me with hedging shears for all I cared. I wanted to hear him play the mandolin or accordion in his shop. I wanted an update on Bud Abbott. I wanted the mafia jokes, the one-liners coming fast and furious, with the whole barbershop his stage, customers part of the act. Let the scissors do their worst as long as time was killed. Actually, I think I'll just read you this one paragraph about Bud Abbott at the end. He knows it's time to go, and almost on cue, time to speak one last time about Bud Abbott. Once when he was sick, my wife and I drove to his house to give him his cut. Louis recalls looking out the window at encroaching buildings. He asked my wife to come sit next to him while I trimmed away. He was watching something on TV. It was an Abbott and Costello movie, Buck Privates. As we watched, he grew a little astonished as he watched himself driving a car. I never drove a car in my life, Abbott said. I had epilepsy. But they made me drive the car down a hill. The cameraman ran like he was going to be killed. What did he tell you about Lou Costello? I asked Luigi. Oh, no, the man who had introduced me to Bud told me, don't talk about Lou. Since Lou died, Bunt ain't nobody. He laid an egg in every show he did. He was actually mad at Lou Costello for dying. I don't know about you guys, but I consider who's on first, what's on second, I don't know, on third, one of the great acts of all time. I used to listen to it, replay it on a little tape machine that I had taped. Okay, we'll end with an act of forgiveness. This is one of the longest, the second longest piece in the book. Louis gets the barber of Tarzan. Actually, the whole book is dedicated to my uncle Gary, Awad, who I call the Ah for Awad, and he calls me the O for Orphala. So it's for Gare, the Ah to this O. My mother's youngest brother, who's been my older brother most of my life. Didn't have one. Well, how to introduce this. All I can tell you is, briefly, I ran away from this piece for a long time. Writing Messengers of the Lost Battalion kind of opened it up a bit, but I still didn't address the situation of how my father died. I talked about it a little bit toward the end of the book, I think. I would say it took about 17 years. He died, and my sister, in 1985, within a matter of seconds. And it took the oxygen out of the family's life for a while. And even a writer is sometimes struck dumb, and I was for several years, really. But this piece is an attempt, it's a long piece, and it goes through all kinds of things surrounding their deaths. But what I'm going to read you is just the beginning of an act of forgiveness, a middle part where I go to a gun shop, and the last part, which is where I go to the cemetery where they're buried with my mother. And I hope that'll give you kind of the range of my concerns and confrontations. An act of forgiveness. The whole purpose of forgiveness is to become free. Whatever you don't forgive imprisons you. Marco Pardo, an old high school friend of mine who I will be seeing tomorrow when we play in our little high school band. He's also a substance abuse counselor. 16 years before the nation's Black Day, our family met its own September 11th, but with no one to hunt down or indict. In the days following our catastrophe, local newspapers printed a few accounts, quote, family argument turns to tragedy. But we were soon left alone to begin our years of sadness. We buried my father and sister at Holy Cross Cemetery in Culver City in August 1985. Arif and Leslie. So much of their lives were intertwined, their dancing, the garments that he manufactured and she wore, their long parallel falls from grace, and their deaths. For most of those 16 years, forgiveness for the person who sealed their fate was the last thing on my mind. Despite advice to the contrary, people who are unable to forgive create cutoffs, and these can be lethal. A family therapist once told me it affects your children and your grandchildren. But I could not hear him. Forgiveness, as our family physician reminded me, is not only central to a healthy life. It is, quote, one of the only ways we can approach God. He went on to say that whatever man endeavors to do, God does one better. We make a building, he makes a flower. But in forgiving, we engage in something godlike. We have a general sense of forgiveness as caving in. But forgiveness is central to the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition. In the Old Testament, fire-breathing Jeremiah hears his maker declare, I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more. Forgiveness is the very lodestone of the New Testament, from the prodigal son to the Lord's Prayer itself, whose only repeated verb is forgive. Right up to the cross, where Christ exonerates his murderers. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. That's Luke chapter 23. My old childhood schoolmate and substance abuse counselor, Marco Pardo, comments, Christ does not want to die with a poisoned heart. And the Quran makes it clear, God is much forgiving, a dispenser of grace. Surah Al-Imran, chapter 3, verse 86 to 91. Still, the years did not soften my resolve. But the agony of a nation did. Whether the Al-Qaeda terrorists are hunted down completely, whether the last bandit is snuffed out, the survivors of those who died in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and the fields of Pennsylvania may arrive, if they haven't already, where I arrived in 2002. For the first time since the deaths of my father and sister, I found myself cresting a hill at Holy Cross Cemetery amid the drum of the cars below on the San Diego freeway and the sound of my own feet avoiding the graves of strangers. I weighed the enormity of my family's loss and finally allowed myself to wonder about what can be forgiven and what cannot. August 2nd, 1985. It was a Friday. I had just gotten home after work, looking forward to playing with our newborn boy, who was lolling with his mother on our bed in a small brick row house in Washington, D.C. The phone rang. My first reaction to what my brother said, "Greg, I'll need you now for the rest of my life," was to laugh. That sort of sentimentality didn't seem like him. I even laughed when he spat out that our sister had shot and killed our father at the family store and then killed herself. A co-worker and a customer had managed to crawl out through the front door, he said. I assumed it was one of his attempts to catch me off guard, so I waited for the punchline. There was none, only the silence and heavy breathing of someone who is pricing each inhale for the first time in his life. I'm skipping. There's a section here where we have to get my mother home. My mother was in England at the time. Her first trip abroad, visiting Gary, who the book is dedicated to. And over the, you know, we didn't have cell phones then. It was, what would it be? Cable, phone line. We discussed, it was the middle of the night, how to get her back without having her have a heart attack. So we had to lie to her. Or we had to restrict the truth. And we said that, and I try and go through this whole thing. You know, basically, tell her he was in an accident and to get her on the plane. And don't tell her anything more. So Gary came all the way from Britain with her to Los Angeles with her sitting next to him in the plane saying, "What else do you know?" And apparently he would turn away from her and just... I'm going to take you now to the gun store where my sister bought the gun. There is a whole section in this thing about gun control. We got very active, but I'm going to skip over it and go right to the source. Some years after our dark day in August, I walked alone into National Gun Sales off by itself in the dust on a dry stretch of Parthenia Boulevard along the railroad tracks. What hits you in a gun shop right off is the sheer number of weapons. Shotguns and assault rifles spread like along the walls like wings of a forbidding flock. I dawdled for a while at one of the racks of magazines and books dealing with hunting, shooting, explosives, soldiers of fortune, quote, men without women, as Hemingway once called them. What did my sister feel coming into this dark den? Did she know she was entering her death? Did she think the gun would melt and enwrap her like a protective cloak? From the ammo boxes, the clerk came, seeing me staring at a .38 Smith Wesson. Nice piece of equipment, he said quietly. Uh-huh. You want to see it? All right. He brought it out of the light and laid it slowly on the glass, just enough for the trigger guard to tick. It was cool. The butt pocked for a good grip, not light. Feel good? Yeah. I wanted to buy a gun. For the first time in my life. You'll like it. No one ever brings one back. Uh-huh. Something in the way he spoke and moved. Back toward the ammo, under the gun wings, arms folded like the director of the universe, made me touch the box of cartridges. He moved directions on an orange card in front of me like a draw card to an inside straight. Here's a shooting range down the block if you want to try it out. They've got them there. Sure. The door opened on the light. The light shined in the darkness, and the darkness grasped it. And this is the end. The rind of a decade and a half cracked first at the library shootings at Littleton, Colorado, and then was shattered by September 11th. An inner wall had been hit by the axe of mass violence. Kafka took such violence metaphorically as the purpose of literature, an axe at the frozen heart. That's how I came to be threading my way through the lids of the dead at Holy Cross Cemetery in 2002. On that gusty, bright February morning, the wind was a hand. For all the justifiable outrage over bin Laden and his henchmen, the hue and cry had begun to make me wonder about the nature of revenge. Yes, they need to be brought to justice. But more than half the battle in staving off the recurrence of such heinous acts is to try and understand why they happen in the first place and to do something about the milieu of deprivation, injustice, and hatred that brings people to such an abyss. We need to look at the history of the region and our poor part in it. Slamming the door on terror through force is not nearly enough and may in itself reap a bitter harvest. I finally realized that I couldn't begin to think of forgiveness until I looked closely at the human face that took my loved ones, the history of that face, and the depths of despair that mental illness brought to it. I had to face my sister in the way I have been given to confront such things, through writing. At the cemetery, my mother filled a jug of water at the tap by the road and handed it to me. It was my first time there since our loved ones were killed 17 years before. Mother carried with her two miniature rose bushes, one yellow, one fire engine red. It took a while to find the graves. I always get lost, she said, angling from the grotto of St. Joseph down through the gravestones, searching for her marker, sycamore. Passed a replica of the Pieta, and I thought, did my sister hold my father in her arms? When she spotted the tree, Mother walked straight to their graves, two black stone markers side by side like a table setting for two. She knelt and with a cloth wiped the markings of snails, dead insects, and dirt. Soon the darkness shone below her knotted hand. I busied myself, uprooting the shaggy grass along the edges of the black stones, just as my father used to do for his parents' graves here, as if you could tidy sorrow. The crabgrass was thicker on Leslie's grave. Mom gave me her scissors, but I said I needed a spade, and she produced one. We placed the two small pots side by side, red for Dad, yellow for Les, and watered this bridge between them before arching our backs to pray. My father's grave reads, Arif Joseph Orfila, beloved father and husband, 1924-1985, go get him. That last was his favorite imperative to all who would truly live, and I was glad to see it. Then I caught the figure on Leslie's grave, an angel kneeling, hands clasped, wings drawn up. The prayer etched there startled me. May you be dancing in the light of God. It was a less profane, more redemptive version of Father Columba's eulogy, Leslie and Arif are dancing with the angels, that had struck me back then as impossible, even absurd. Mother had produced a spiritual upgrade, a sign of her instinctive forgiveness, and she had done it very early on. I hadn't. I had held my anger like a stone as black as their graves. But that day, the words fell out of me. I forgive you, sister. Forgive me. The grades. The anger. The judgment. The distance. The dirt. I also said to myself, forgive God. When I stood up facing west, it was colder. A cloud had covered the sun. I looked straight ahead. There, downhill through a hole in a stand of eucalyptus, past the San Diego freeway and the town of Inglewood, was the sea. It shined like a melted coin. If I moved slightly to the left or to the right of either of their graves, it disappeared. I pointed this out to Mother, who smiled and said she'd never seen it before, had never looked beyond their graves that way. We both agreed it was a great vantage point, almost worth 17 years of heartache to discover. She muttered something about poets seeing beauty everyone else misses. A shaft of light came through the cloud. It touched on the St. Joseph statue and slowly crept across the grass. I thought, of course, well, on cue, huh? Let me start over that paragraph. A shaft of light came across the cloud. It touched on the St. Joseph statue and slowly crept across the grass. I thought, of course, that it was leading to us. Then I took my shadow off and walked with Mother back to the road. Thank you.
Does anyone have any questions or comments?
Yeah, Ron.
You're pretty confident then that California is not going to break off and fall in the ocean.
Yeah, I think it's going to be there for a while.
So how long have you been back in California now?
Well, I actually was teaching there for 3 years, 2004 to 2007, but I came back 2 years ago. I'll just simply say it was a health issue of my wife, partly, that brought me back. But I still want to come back west. We'll get there.
One moment.
Is it the first book for you? Is it a therapy for you to help others, or also you wrote this book?
Is it my first book? No, it's my eighth.
Eight?
But it's, I think in some ways it contains the hardest writing for me. I mean, the stuff that was difficult to...
To help yourself and help other
yes.
people in your situation.
Well, I have to say that, in all honesty, my mother never read it when it was, the Act of Forgiveness, when it was first published in the Los Angeles Times Magazine. And she never read it when it went in here. Well, no, I take that back. It was published in the LA Times Magazine in 2003. This just came out this year. About 4 years passed, maybe 2 years ago, before the book came out, we had quite an argument about whether it would go in. And I had to pass certain phrases through my brother. She wouldn't, you know, I'd give it to my brother and he'd take the phrase and show it to her and she'd try and do something with it. It was a very difficult thing to describe my sister's mental illness, which was schizophrenia. She didn't want that word in, you can imagine. Yaibashum, right, in Arabic. Shame on you. But you're right. About 2 years ago, maybe 7 years or so, 6 years, 5 years after it appeared in the Times, she read it. She just got up the courage. And she called me and said, I read your piece. I couldn't believe it. I didn't think she was ever going to confront it. And I said, well, what did you think? You know, the longest silence in my life. And she said, it was very difficult, but I think it will help other people. Well, you couldn't ask for more. I think we're probably not alone. But we're particularly, it's particularly difficult for us for some reason. I don't know why, frankly. Maybe you have some insights about that. Carol, anything? Yeah.
I think knowing... issues in my own family that there's something about in our culture the family is the family and we
protective.
We protect what we know.
Yeah.
And also I think being minorities in a majority culture we don't want to reveal anything wrong.
Any cracks in the facade. Yeah, you know. I think there's some truth to that. Yes?
I think American culture is incredibly blind to illness that's mental.
Mental illness, yeah.
And I think, you know, these issues came up since I've been living in Ann Arbor with some family members, and I think, again, it's my only experience, but sometimes I wonder the more educated the town, the less that they want to identify that... It, you know, it's like Lake Obegon. We only have perfect children and everything's wonderful here.
We all have high IQs and that should take care of it all.
Right, so we're perfect and have no problems. And I think, in fact, if people were just honest about it and did share, it's very painful and you go through this whole thing, it's my fault. It's nobody's fault. It's just what it is.
It's an illness.
But it's very, very difficult, and I commend you because I think it is very difficult to share our sorrows.
It was, as this woman here intimated, it helped me, believe me, as much, if not more, than it would help anyone else. It 1,000 pounds off the shoulder when I finally wrote it. Ron.
Greg, had your sister been diagnosed? Was she under any kind of treatment at the time?
Well, good
medication,
question.
Therapy, whatever.
Well, there's a whole section about her mental illness difficulties. But I'll say, Ron, she had been to a mental hospital. You know, she heard voices. That's the classic beginning of schizophrenia. And it often happens in late teens, early 20s. It hit her when she was 20 and a junior at college. And we did all these experiments trying to figure out, was it in her ears, you know? Was it her diet? And, you know, you try everything, and finally you realize it's something else. She went through a 10-year period of slow downward spiral. It was agony for my parents, for all of us, but particularly for my parents. Curiously enough, the word schizophrenia was never used until she was gone. And I discovered it in hospital records. Her psychiatrist, she was in a mental hospital for 8 months at one point. In the 7th month, it enters the record. Why so late? And obviously he never communicated to my mother and father because they never used the word. It was low, depressed, you know. She had medications at various times. She had different therapists at various times. The deaths occurred in 85, but she started hearing voices in 75, I think, roughly 75. You know, so, they didn't have it really diagnosed. They knew she could be violent, though. And it's in the piece, I confront... I think the medicines now probably are much better than they were. She threw her medicines away, which is not uncommon even today, but they have less side effects today. Sure. And I have a hunch, you know, sad to say, that maybe she might have been able to be saved. But I threatened my folks at one point when she sort of stalked down the hallway between the bedrooms at the family home one night and banged on my door when I was sleeping. And I opened the door, it was like 2 a.m. And she was standing there, she went and started yelling at me, and she put something behind her back. I'm convinced it was a gun. And I came that close. Actually, at the time I thought it was a knife because I couldn't think of who, my sister with a gun? But knowing way things happened, she actually had purchased 2 guns at 2 different times. And the fact that she could get it in the midst of a psychotic event with her eyes dilated and staccato speech and a bloody hand blows my mind. Oh, well, Cho. Look what Cho did at Virginia Tech. So we haven't learned much on that score. It's just an absolute shame. Yes, Carol?
What I find so compelling about that poem, of course I'm saddened and I'm for your loss and I'm...
Thank you.
I'm...
Thank you.
How can I say it? I don't know the word, but yeah. I'm not a poet. But I'm, heartened that you could write about it and get over that. But it's the forgiveness part that has such a deep spiritual... message for me. The days that I don't forgive over stupid little things.
Oh, yeah. I've done it with my kids.
And then even politically, the forgiveness about political events that anger me.
Oh, yeah.
This is just where you have arrived is where I think so many of us want to be. And I'm not saying you're there completely on every issue.
It's a life.
It's a process.
Lifelong. It's interesting you say. I really appreciate you saying that.
Really appreciate your writing.
Well, I had a response from a man who. Do you know Ben Bateen? Remember, he was with us in Kansas State. Yeah, Ben Bateen, Dr. Ben Bateen or Baton. It's a Syrian name. He teaches psychology at Seton Hall. And he is a psychotherapist, remember? He's a very interesting guy. He's been emailing me after reading this piece. I don't know if I should share this. It's pretty private. Well, let's just say that somebody in his family took their own life. And he's been trying to understand it his whole life. And he said, the process you went, he keeps asking, what was the process? It's hard to say. There's many false starts. I shut off seeing their graves. That probably didn't help. Going with my mother was a good idea. Going with someone who's stronger, who was stronger. You know, I asked Ben, do you have a sister, your wife, whatever. She and I was angry at her for doing that. Because it was an indication she was on another level. And I wasn't there. You know, I also thought she was dismissing what had happened to my father, in a way. But she didn't. You know, she was something. She is something. She is an amazing human being.
I just want to, like Carol said, about forgiveness.
Right.
So many people, it affect them forgiveness. I mean, without forgiveness, it affect them badly. And this is will help them a lot to read the story and how you suffered.
Right.
And how you reach a point of forgiveness and you help others, really. I really appreciate what you did. Thank you.
Yes.
I don't know if I find it frightening or it just shows we're all human before we're a professional, but that a psychotherapist doesn't know or a psychiatrist. I mean, that just shows how personal that is, and everything you learn is blocked off.
The psychiatrist she had at the end, after she had her break.
Your friend.
Oh, my friend, Van Bateen. Yeah. No. And he, you know who he treats? He has a very unusual practice, which is why he was at Kansas State. We went to a conference, Carol and I, together, on Arab American women about... No.
Oh.
That's another story. Ben counsels people, largely people of Middle Eastern background, although not entirely, who were thrown into prison willy-nilly right after 9/11, spent months or years and had no charges filed and came out, you know, bleary-eyed, wondering what happened to their life. You can imagine the trauma. No guilt, no charges, just thrown in prison. And that happened to 2,000 people, from what we've been able to gather. That's a lot of people in a free society where there's a writ of habeas corpus. So Ben, you know, challenges himself. He has a practice dealing with extremely difficult cases psychologically, and yet, as you say, he still has some difficulties of his own, as we all do.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Okay.
Doesn't know you, right? But I grew up in the same area.
No, that's not true. Are you? Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, but I grew up in the
grew
same
up the same area,
would
right?
Would you mind giving me a little bio? Like, okay, so you grew up in L.A.
Yeah.
Where did you go to undergrad? Where did you go to grad?
Oh, that sure. I grew up in L.A. Born and raised downtown at 3rd and Alvarado, St. Vincent's Hospital, and raised in Anaheim, then over to the Valley when I was 12. I saw the Matterhorn being built at Disneyland when I was a kid. I've written a short story about it called The Portrait of the Artist in Disneyland's Shadow. And the new book's coming out this year with that at the head. Short stories. Went to Georgetown. That's what brought me back east. Our group of students, we had about six or seven of us from Crespi High who went east. We went the first group of graduates who ever went east of the Mississippi. One guy went to West Point. One guy went to Yale, Eric Klosterman, our valedictorian. Two of us went to Georgetown, and I can't remember one. Oh, a couple went to Notre Dame. It was, and we kept in touch with each other. We used to hitchhike and visit each other. We were the Westerners in the East. And, you know, I went to Alaska, of all places, for my master's in fine arts and creative writing. In those days, there was only seven programs for creative writing. In the master's level, there are now 100. So, yeah, just an explosion.
What made you decide to go to Alaska for your MFA?
Boy, I've been asked that question many times, and I don't have a great answer to it. To be honest with you, that's the answer, because I applied to two places. Iowa, which is the Harvard of the writing programs, right? I didn't get in. And I got in a full ride, full cross-country ski. In Alaska. And I always was fascinated with the far north for a Californian. We spent time in a cabin. My father had bought us a cabin when we were growing up in the lower Sierras near Lake Arrowhead. And I kind of liked the snow, which was a bit unusual. And I kind of liked the idea of living out in the woods. I was very influenced by Thoreau, as most of my generation was. Writers of that sort. Annie Dillard became someone I liked quite a bit. I lived out in a cabin with no running water for a year, with no one else within a mile. Crazy things you do when you're 22.
Greg, have you had difficulty finding publishers interested in your work? Why and I wonder that? If you.
Good question, Carol.
I know.
I didn't read from it, but there is an essay. This book is divided in half.
The reason I asked that is because we're Arab
American. Right. Well, I wanted to mention, Carol, that the half the book, the first half is memoirs of growing up in L.A., and it's not particularly ethnic, although it kind of comes in and out in the Kingdom of Rags piece. The second half are a lot of essays about the Middle East and my background. And one of the essays is called Facing the Wall. What's the subtitle? Arab Americans in Publishing. So I took a couple of chances. It's kind of long. I'll summarize one or two things. And I kind of got up enough nerve to speak out on a couple things in this book in addition to mental illness. And one of them is that, first you got to say, you have to say right off the bat when you talk about discrimination in publishing, that it is just very hard to publish a good book. Anybody, no matter what your background in this country. This is a country with universal education, although maybe it's devolving rather than evolving. But for the most part, people, there's a lot of educated people who go to these 100 writing programs. Competition is stiff, is what I mean to say. So having said that, I was asked by, actually ADC, Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, asked me to speak on this topic. And that's where I got the impetus to write it up. I had a couple of incidents, and I'll tell you one or two, that really shocked me in a way and in some ways silenced me for a while. And I know if it happened to me, it's probably happened to others. I know of no other writer who's been able to pin it down, though, because it's risky to say this. And you don't want to sound like you're whining. But years ago, I had written part of a novel, maybe about half of a novel or a third. It was called Mirage, and it was set in 1936 in Palestine, in Haifa, actually, where I've never been. So it was perfect for fiction since I had no idea what it looked like. I made it up, did some reading, but it was the story of a Jewish-Arab marriage, Arab-Jewish intermarriage, and the four children from that intermarriage. And I kind of told the Israel-Palestine conflict through these four dual heritage children. It's an old ploy. I mean, Shakespeare did plenty with this kind of double heritage and whatnot, mistaken identities. So it wasn't very original, but I had some fun with it, and I think I learned some things writing it. I had an agent named Elaine Markson, Jewish agent, very good. She loved it. She said, this is going to be an event. I'll never forget her saying that. I said, no, wait a second. Forget the event, Elaine. Just get it published. Forget the event. And she, sure enough, she was good at what she did. She got it on the desk of the top fiction editor at Old Little Brown, whose name was Frederica Friedman. Her name was Freddie Friedman. Nickname, Freddie Friedman. Yeah. Frederica Friedman had been the editor of Shogun. Remember Shogun? Very successful, highly successful novel about Japan. So Freddie Friedman called me one day. And I still kind of have difficulty thinking, did this really, come on, Greg, are you remembering it right? Because it sounds so outrageous, but I'm afraid I do remember it. She said, Mr. Orfila, you are about a interesting, fascinating mission. I said, Miss Friedman, I'm not about any mission. I just write about my obsessions and I try and follow where they take me. I'm not on a mission. And she said, well, I think you write very well, and this is a fascinating story, but I'm not going to publish it. I said, really? You called me to tell me that? That's very nice of you. What a friendly thing to do. Yeah. And I said, may I ask why? And she said, because of who you are. put my hand on the Bible. I said, no. And, you know, I had this temptation to say, who am I? You know, tell me, who am I? But I said something like, can you explain that, please? And she said, look, if you were Jewish and you wrote this story, people would believe it. But because you're not, they're not going to believe it. No, I won't do that, particularly with a book like that. Pseudonym. I just won't do it. You know, I just maybe thinking back on it, maybe I should have. I was a little too overly principled. I don't think Frederica Freeman was saying that it was a bad book. I don't think she was saying that she didn't want to publish it. I think she was making a statement about the market. And that, and the fact that, by the fact, mere fact, there was an Arab American writing about this union. There was a credibility factor. What was my motive? Was I manipulating things? In other words, I could not be a reliable narrator, de facto. And that really bothered me, and it stopped me writing for a while.
Some young lady who was Jewish, a comment like that.
Well,
and she said that she's disappointed reading the book because you were not fair to Israel.
You hear that every. There are a lot of Jews that are called anti-Semitic because they criticize Israel. I want to say one thing. Needless to say, I don't feel like I have to say this, but some of the best friends to my work have been Jewish, particularly my editor at Simon Schuster, Adam Bellow, Saul Bellow's son. Knew me, knew what I was doing instinctively. So I'm not saying that every time I've been presented with this problem that I get hit back by one of my cousins. No. But it happened that time, and
There's a question back here.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you some questions.
Sure.
But before maybe you dealt with these.
Yeah,
When you started out your lecture, I'm sorry I was a little bit...
Not at all. No problem.
I live on the south side of town.
Well, it's nice that you came all that way.
So we got a little bit lost here that time. But anyway, can you say something about the Arab population in general in Los Angeles area?
Yeah, surely.
When did they immigrate to that area? For what reason?
Sure.
From what countries?
Sure.
And your own family, especially.
Yeah, it's a big community. You know, right now it's sort of neck and neck between Detroit and L.A., although some demographers think that L.A. has begun to pass Detroit. I guess they use the 400,000 figure for Detroit, I think, and Dearborn. Well, Dearborn and then the area. Metro area. And L.A., I don't know.
Yeah, but L.A., they come from Iran.
No, the Iranians are 600,000. The Iranians are bigger than the Arab Americans in L.A. That's why they call it Irangelis. But anyway, to answer your gentleman's question, people came to the West fairly early on from the Arab world. One of the first immigrants was a Muslim named Haj Ali, who was nicknamed Hijali.
He was in the 19th century. He
came in the 19th century, about 1865, something like that, and he came as a camel driver, literally, taking camels. The U.S. Army hired him to take the camels across Texas through the Southwest, thinking that they were going to open up a trail of camels. But the problem was that the camels, you know, padded foot was used to sand, not hard stones, and they cut their feet up so badly, the poor camels ran away. I think some of them ran away, or they didn't want anything. They weren't good for packing supplies. There were people that came later from Lebanon, particularly in Syria. Lebanese and Syrians, and to some extent Palestinians, made up 90% of the first wave.
Mostly Christians, though.
Most, 90%. 90% Christian, yeah.
Maronites.
Maronite, Orthodox, Melkite, right. My family was actually both Orthodox and Melkite. My grandmother, Nazira Orfila, was Melkite. And there was evidence of a very early farmer coming to California in around 1918 after World War I, where he saw starvation in Lebanon. Lebanon lost about a quarter of its population to starvation in World War I. It's not known very well. That's a lot of people. And this gentleman's name was Haddad. Why am I forgetting his first name? I grew up with him. He was like Ummu, an old uncle. Tawfiq Haddad? I can't remember his first name. But anyway, he was responsible. He was the potato king. He was responsible for selling Safeway half of its spring potatoes. He had all these potato farms in Idaho as well as in California. The community grew exponentially after World War II. That's when my family came from Cleveland, Ohio, my father's family, and from Brooklyn, New York, my mother's family, for various reasons, one of which was health. My grandfather had bad emphysema, and he needed to go to a sunshine. They checked out Florida, and as my grandmother, his wife, put it, "Honey, we didn't go to Florida because they had sunshine and no business. In California, they have sunshine and business."
From Lebanon?
I'm sorry?
From Lebanon?
She was from Lebanon. He was from Syria. Although that was all Syria
Lebanon
in the 19...
Lebanon was part of Syria,
right? I'm sorry?
Lebanon was part of Syria.
It was until 19... 43. Roughly 43, right.
Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. At that time, they were part of the same province.
I'm sorry. We will have time for one more question, and then, Greg, you're going to be able to sign some books, right?
I'd be happy to, yeah.
Did you have a question?
Well, I was just going to ask Greg from what part of Lebanon and Syria did...
Relatives? My grandfather, Orfila Arif Sr., was from Homs, although there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that Orfila is Min Urfa, which is in southeastern Turkey, and that we might be partly Armenian. Nobody knows for sure. They came down to Homs. Okay, so then his wife, Jabali, was from Zahli, Nazira Jabali. And then on my mother's side, my grandfather Camel was from outside Damascus, Arbin, yeah, right, and farming village. They were all farmers, really, in the old world. And then his wife, Matil, was from higher up the Lebanon mountain from Bekfeya. Like, it was called Shrin, or Mahaiti. It was a tiny little village up in the Lebanon mountain. Well,
thank you very much for sharing, and that was really interesting.
Thank you. Good to be here.